Okay, we are back. We are back. We had a little bit of a bumpy ride because this is East is a podcast, and I am your host. But we got here. We got to the promised land. Speaking of promised land, we have two people here with us who are experts in that place. No, I'm just kidding. This is an episode. I was just being stupid. I was trying to segue into introducing this episode, but it's really dumb. And I'm just going to say what it is. I am bugging Adam and Nora for a while now to talk about philo-Semitism. Now, if you don't know what that word means, it just means it's a kind of catch-all term for a love or fascination with Jews and Jewishness. And so I've been thinking about this issue for a while, and I've been like texting with you guys, and I brought in my Council of Jews. No, I'm just kidding.
We're even matching today, me and Adam.
No, but this is something that's also like I thought about a lot because it's also affected my own like life and as a scholar. Like I mentioned before, part of my dissertation involves studying a text that sort of concerns itself with the Shoah, with somebody who was on the Kinder transport. So I went to archives. I like, you know, did this research trip to concentration camp, a sort of famous one, not the one that's kind of on the off the beaten track, Theresienstadt, you know, the one that's in Prague. It was like kind of a fake city that set up. So anyways, I did all of this and I had a lot of colleagues, you know, I went to conferences and stuff, but it was always something in the back of my mind that said, you know, this immense fascination we have, like in the academic sphere specifically, but also in the broader cultural sphere you can extend it to, with Jews and Jewishness. Like, what is it rooted in? Like, where does it, like, explain it to me. Like, is it, like, because we're talking about a relatively small population, right? Like, the numbers of Jews in the world, is it many? It's 12 million, 15 or something. Most of them live in two countries. You know, like that's it. And like most of them speak English and are kind of Anglo, whatever. And I mean, I guess there is another question about the Slavification of everything, but that's a different thing. But I guess in the meantime, like where I wanted to sort of begin this conversation is, do you think there is a particularly strong sort of strain of philo-Semitism to our culture specifically, because this is where like the majority of Jews reside? I don't know who wants to start with that. It's a big mess of a question.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different ways to analyze where we are right now in this moment in time, in terms of how Judaism is expressed, how it is seen, how it is weaponized, how it is articulated. Because of the last, you know, 100 or so years of Zionism as a political ideology, and the subsequent weaponization of Judaism in order to establish and maintain a Western settler colonial experiment of imperialism in Western Asia, there is a level of, you know, the way in which Western power and the Western power elite has absolutely become enraptured with, you know, with Jewish people, because it has, and Zionism has, conflated Judaism and this political ideology of Zionism. And so, you know, you see like, you know, the good Jews who are in power in, you know, the halls of government here in the US, you know, very influential in the cultural sphere, you know, who are very much assets of the Western power elite in furthering, you know, this Western imperialist hegemon, you know, whereas like a lot of Orthodox Jewish Yiddish speaking communities in, let's say, upstate New York, for example, who are inherently anti-Zionist And, you know, you see them marching. I mean, they're also in Toronto. Like, you know, you see communities of Orthodox Jews marching in solidarity with Palestinians, getting beaten up by Zionists. And they are absolutely invisibilized by Western media, by the Western power structure itself, as well as, you know, anti-Zionist, non-religious or, you know, not Orthodox Jews such as myself and Adam and many, many, many others in this country and around the world who are also smeared by Zionists and by people who are in power as, you know, I mean, I'm sure you get this too a lot, Adam, but like pretty much every day I get called a traitor, a capo, other words, you know, very kind of vitriolic hatred toward Jews who don't ascribe to the political ideology of Zionism, don't support the Israeli state at all, don't support the U.S. state for that matter as well. And we're being, you know, also subjected to censorship and silencing and arrest. And my Jewishness doesn't, you know, afford me any privilege in that power dynamic because I'm not a supporter of the Israeli state and of Zionism and of the Western hegemon. So there's this absolute, like, also, you know, a fetishization of Jewishness and Judaism and, you know, this sort of like very convenient structure that has been built in order to codify Zionism as a twinned identity with Judaism and to use the trauma, you know, generational trauma of violence against Jews exclusively by Europe, pretty much, and its European acolytes it's a very European concept to otherize people who are not white and Christian, obviously. And for a long, long time, way before Zionism, Jews in Europe were otherized. And then when Zionism came along and the Israeli state was founded and it became, you know, really a rampart for Western imperial interests in the region, then Jews as a category was subdivided. Western imperialist interests will coddle and protect and embolden any faction of a certain community when it is supporting the interests of the imperialists, I think. And so that's, I think, where...
Which is the lesson of Ukraine. Everybody suddenly became like the blue and yellow fanatic. And most liberals probably hadn't thought about Ukraine in 15 years.
Right.
Until...
People didn't even know what it was. Yeah. I think it's important to look at it historically and, you know, obviously, like, we can't divorce its context from political fact and reality. That's where I'm going.
I mean, I agree with everything that Nora said. And in a way, so I am 50 years old. I was born in 1973. And I think in many ways, this process, what we're talking about today, has been like the story of my lifetime. I think like before... The late 60s and 70s, and, you know, like when you're talking about the role of like philo-Semitism on the campus or anything, I think that all looked very different a generation or two ago. Like, it's sort of been like my lifetime, maybe our life, you know, where this shift has happened. And I mean, I don't want to say everything Nora just said again, but like, you know, it's really been this process of Jews assimilating into whiteness, by which I really mean assimilating into the power establishment of the West, of the United States, where this, you know, it was making that agreement to do that, which engendered this philo-Semitism. And so that clearly Zionism has a very large part of it. It's broader than that, though, too. And like, I'm going to be interested when we get into this conversation about Judaism and Zionism, because I think in some ways there's a very simple answer to this, and in other ways there's a much more complicated answer. And this kind of chicken and the eggness, where that yolk is pretty mixed at this point, and what that means. But it all, like, for those who ascribe to these beliefs, it is a ticket into whiteness, into power, and into then being on the receiving end of this, like, philo-Semitism, of this very specific view of what Judaism looks like, what being Jewish looks like, the examples that Nora shared of the people who are extremely Jewish but fall outside that definition are very clear. But yeah, this is, you know, it's been one of the things that I feel lucky at in my time with Mondo Weiss is, you know, Philip Weiss founded the website. He is a generation older than I am. And hearing him narrate this process, I've found it's been so clarifying to me and explaining my own experience and sort of like what I saw happening before my own eyes. So yeah, it's been the story of our generation.
No, I appreciate both of those. And I know it was kind of like I had a much better opening salvo before I started recording than actually when I started recording, because like twisting all of this apart, you get, and I think this is partly the reason why like the history, like philo-Semitism has been integrated so intensely with academic studies, because once you twist apart, like say, let's call it the Jewish question, which now, unfortunately for history, has become the Jewish Zionist question, like amended, like the European question of Judaism, so-called the Jewish question, which for people who don't know, wasn't just about Jews, was about the condition of minorities, right? Like other people. This was like Jews were the litmus test, and understanding their position or potential positions in something called Europe, right, was a sort of dilemma, right? And so famously Marx, in his version of answering that question, was like, just stop being Jewish, bro, like assimilate and stop being like your backwards, you know, like peasant self. Like this is how he spoke. And so I think part of the issue here is that once we twist it apart is that, yeah, we have a bunch of different interlocking, overlapping histories of imperialism working simultaneously. Because on the one hand, Jews share a common history with other European minorities in a sense, or other European, let's say, ethnicities. And we can't equalize those things because an Italian, you know, when you talk about Italians in 19th century Europe, whatever, that's also made up. It's just as much as we say, you know, like a Jew in 19th century Europe is like, these are diverse people. These are living across different cultures. They're, some of them are Romanian. Some of them are English. Some of them are, you know, whatever. Right. And so like it's part of, I think, one of the real tools that has sort of trapped us in thinking is that first you make this monolithic body, this non-monolithic body into a monolith. You call them like, oh, the Jews of Europe. Right. And you start then debating, oh, what is the question? What is the answer? Blah, blah, blah. So you have this like almost like a hermeneutical problem, like ontological, but also like philosophical problem of artificially separating out a portion of a population and unifying them under this like ages. But okay, whatever. Putting that aside for now, there's the other thing of like, yeah, then over time, that interaction with European imperialism, like Italians, like Greeks, like a lot of other people in Europe, is that their participation in the great land grab in the New World rendered them equal. And like, we call that assimilation, but really it was a kind of class solidarity that was extended to the so-called racial minorities, right? Like we didn't talk in these terms in 19th century, we didn't talk like this. This is us also like pushing back our like lexicon that we've developed over these centuries, but like the process of racialization of Jews of Europe as Jews itself unfolds in this weird uneven history, because they became white people in the New World, but they stayed Jews in Europe, right? Like they became, like they were slave owners in Jamaica and the New World, right? But in Europe, a ton of them stayed, you know, like the unwanted masses, and their question still lingered to the point where like, you know, like millions of Germans and Germanic speaking people and their European allies were like, all right, let's just get rid of these people. We're tired of, you know, and like that was into the 40s, right? And so it didn't, the Jewish question wasn't solved simply by like going to the colonies. and doing as the whites did, right? Is that it lingered on. And this is always something, and I feel that in some ways Zionism squared the circle of European Jewry. They said, oh yeah, we can do what you guys do. We can colonize. We can like get together and make a bunch of like angry fascist gangs. We can like, you know, use our racial supremacy, like an idea of racial supremacy to tie together a bunch of disparate fucking cultures who have nothing to do with each other, by the way. An English middle-class dude who like migrates to Tel Aviv to like, you know, drink beer and like be like live in a warm place has nothing in common with like a dude from your rural Ukraine who pretended to be Jewish so he could migrate. Like these people have nothing in common,
yeah.
Right? And except Zionism says, yes, you do. You have the supremacy of your race, right? Over this other people who are non-Jew. And so it's like, it's a crazy, like this is what bugs me. Like this is philo-Semitism, and I feel like, is it an extension of this? Is it part of like a, are you now allowed to be professionally Jewish in a way that you weren't, say, 60 years ago when like, you know, whites would like spit on Jewish people and keep them out of their food dining clubs? Like Edward Said was more accepted at Princeton than his Jewish peers. Think about that for a second. Like in his memoir, he talks about like how Jews were excluded from the dining clubs at like Princeton in the 50s. That was the 50s. And he was more accepted because he was a Christian Lebanese, like Arab, like Palestinian Arab, like Levantine, you know. So it's all of this is so mind-boggling, the scale. And now you have all these chuds, and you fast forward today, right-wing chuds who are like as American as anything, any garbage, who Israel gives them a reason to exist. You know, like Israel gives them a reason to fly a flag, you know, and it's like, wow, like all of this, just like you think about it. I know that wasn't even a question. That was just like a big blurting of all these different. But like this is the mess of all of this, separating all of this.
Yeah, we saw it this weekend, and I don't know the names and the details here. I don't know if you know, Nora, if you know, but there was a Jewish anti-Zionist activist who was shot in Boston by a non-Jew who was shooting this Jewish person supposedly out of trying to fight anti-Semitism.
Right.
So like in terms of like the knot that this ties your brain into, we're seeing this all over the place. And especially in these last 11 months of all these, you know, Zionist pro-Israel supporters who hate Jews, who are opposing genocide, you know? So yeah, it's all over.
Yeah. While you have, you know, the Israel supporters, the Zionists saying, you know, this is the latest in the long, you know, sordid history of crimes against Jews because we're Jews. Yeah. Again, like, so yeah, like conflating goes full circle. There are many people who believe that the prison break on October 7th was because Palestinians have this inherent savage hatred toward Jewish people. And, you know, it's really like, the worldview is completely upside down. And so then they could say, you know, see, they hate us. They hate us because we're Jewish and we have to, you know, we have to stand together, and we, you know, and so all these, you know, celebrities are saying, I stand with Jewish people, when it has nothing to do with Judaism, except the weaponization of Judaism to further the settler colonial project with which Palestinians are trying to liberate themselves from. So it makes you feel like you're constantly, you know, going crazy. I mean, really, like, you know, because I don't know, to me growing up, I think I've talked about this maybe before on like a podcast a long time ago, Sina, but with you, but like I was obsessed with Holocaust like nonfiction narratives, especially written by or about children who were in places like Theresienstadt and Auschwitz and Birkenau. And yeah, I was obsessed with these stories of like how could this have happened? And like how what was the effect on children primarily? And how can the country that you called home for generations and generations suddenly turn on you and send you to a death camp? And like, how evil can humans be? It was kind of one of those, you know, some kids are into like horror movies and I was into Holocaust narrative nonfiction. And luckily I was born into a Jewish family that didn't immediately say, you know, which a lot of Zionists do say, is the Jews who were slaughtered in the Holocaust were weak and they didn't fight back. And that's why we need Israel, because now we get to transform this you know, this paradigm of the weak Jew versus the strong, powerful, you know, nuclear addled Israeli state Jew. And I mean, yeah, I think that that's one of many ways in which Zionism has really hijacked Judaism as a mechanism to exert power and militarism. But like, you know, it also kind of, I mean, I was talking to a friend the other day who is, she's in her 70s and she's Jewish. She grew up in Brooklyn and she was like, she was saying like, we can't ever talk about the Holocaust anymore. You know, the Nazi Holocaust. She's like, we've lost that ability to call on people's sympathies and empathies about what happened in the Holocaust, because look what Israel is doing to Palestinians in this genocide, and doing it, you know, many of them doing it under the umbrella of, you know, of this. This is the ultimate feat of strength for Jewish people, that we can, you know, do this to another people, while still claiming victimhood historically. Yeah, so it's interesting to see how people are kind of processing this, and I'm also very encouraged to see people really having a hard time with wrapping their heads, or in the Jewish community, wrapping their heads around, you know, this generational story of, you know, of fighting to survive as, you know, Jewish people, especially in Europe. And then, you know, that being channeled into some sort of, you know, impulse to support a genocidal apartheid state. And people are wrestling with that. And that's good. That's very long overdue. But Ilan Pappé talks about this. Joseph Massad talks about this. This is, you know, Zionism is crumbling before our eyes. The Israeli state has an expiration date, you know, in terms of its viability. What's going to happen before that happens is it's going to get a lot worse, I think, before it gets better. But this is how settler colonies eventually implode, and ideologically, it can't survive.
So one question I have, and it's sort of like, cause I agree with what you were just saying, Nora, and I've like definitely experienced all these dynamics and all these kind of questions within the Jewish community and stuff. And I honestly am a lot less interested in them as I am in this process outside the Jewish community.
Yeah.
And it's kind of the flip side of this philo-Semitism question is like, what has this last year done to that understanding? You know, because so there are the arch imperialists, and we could talk about them, philo-Semitic for their reasons. I'm sure they've quadrupled down in this last year. Yeah. But then there are the other people who feel, because it was like a liberal impulse, because we are against oppression, we are against discrimination, we are against anti-Semitism, we're going, and for that reason, we're going to stand with Jewish people. And I'm being told that standing with Jewish people is supporting this place. And so, yeah, I don't really think about it a whole lot. My church supports this place. And then over this last 11 months, they've watched this genocide and they've come to question a lot of that stuff. I don't know nearly as much about this as I do about some of this wrestling within, say, the Jewish community and this polling and X percent of Jews now support an arms embargo. It's all great. But, and, you know, Nora and I have talked about in other settings, which we might get to here. I don't know. It might be but just sort of like, you know, whatever, the kind of the role of Jews in the Palestine movement and things like that. Ultimately, like the movement is not, shouldn't be, and is not made up of Jews or led by Jews, you know, so it's really bringing in these other masses of perhaps previously Philo-Semitic people, and not to say that they hate Jews now, but they have moved to be much more critical about Zionism and about, you know, the Israeli state. That is sort of one of the stories I'm really interested in trying to understand from this past year. And I say this past year, like it's, things are over, nothing's over. But as we talk about Philo-Semitism, I'm also interested to talk about how it's unraveling, hopefully.
So I think a follow-up question is that then, is that this Philo-Semitic sort of strain of particularly sort of like Anglo culture, like I think Germans have it, obviously, but there's not that many Jews in Germany. Yeah. Like they, so it's done by, it's a weird kind of Philo-Semitism by proxy almost, like over there. And that's what I remember. My life in Germany was sure short, but you know, it's like that. Whereas here it's that Jews and also prominent Zionists, right? Who have Zionism has, you know, we talked about this earlier. Like this is a dominant force in, if you could say the Jewish community, which is something that I, you know, let's just say Jewish communities, that's easier, is that Zionism is a dominant and a predominant force in the sense that above the sort of anti-Zionist view, right? And so like you guys, I mean, it's fair to say, it's obvious to say, that you guys represent a minority in your communities, right? A political faction that's a minority. Yeah. And I wonder, in the long term, and I guess also in the short term too, is that this wholesale adoption of a violent, racist, imperialist, and ultimately like a project underwritten by the greatest anti-Semites to ever exist, and they're the ones who help authorize and midwife this so-called Jewish state. Right, like this is to think in that scale, and then you think about like all of these Zionists right now who are just like flexing like proudly in their genocidal state and say, oh, we're, and as you said, you're like, well, oh, we're not going to be sheep to the slaughter anymore. All those documentaries, like all those documentaries about the Shoah, all those sad people, it's not going to be like us. You know, we're not going to do that. Like their own frothing at the mouth, like need to like make up for that or something, animates so much like support for Zionism, like, and to the point where you're like, oh, so if you don't have killing other people that you deem to be enemies, like as your central goal, like what do you have? Right. Like, and so you wonder that like this project, right, which doesn't like other nationalisms have other things that motivate them, right? Like Jewish nationalism and Zionist nationalism has taken this Zionist form, right? And unfortunately, it has nothing underneath it other than that supremacist impulse. I'm sorry, like it's just, it doesn't have any cultural basis. Like they had to resurrect Hebrew, you know, like that's all, like, you know what I mean? Like that's something, because otherwise it's disparate populations who have nothing in common. Like that's something I want to really, really want to stress to like say out loud. And we have to, because like when was the last time you had like lower cuisine? Like it doesn't exist anymore. So you have to ask that parallel question. What's this going to do long-term to Jewishness? Yeah. Right? Like, and this is a question I asked Morgan, friend of the show, a while back, and she said, she was like, we've been around forever. We'll make our way through this, you know, to the effect. I mean, go listen to the episode. But like, there is a cost to your community, to your people, to history. I know these are all humanistic terms. I'm sorry. I should be a good Marxist and not employ these things. But really, it's a religious belief that when you like burn your religious symbol into the skin of your defenseless enemy, like because it gives you a hard-on, and when you rape them to death, like in prisons, because they made you mad, because they exist, like, and then you do that under the aegis of Jewishness, like that violence will bleed into the symbols. Like there's no undoing that. Like I'm not Jewish, so these are not my symbols to like to really discuss. But I, as like an observer to this, you know, like it makes you like it really thinks that like you will like these scenes will be etched into history.
Yeah.
Like, you know,
I had a prediction coming into this that you were going to come off as like the most Jewish person in this conversation. So it might already be happening. But I will just say, I mean, of course, I agree with everything you said. And one of the things that like I've had conversations I've been thinking about, I mean, so I shared my age earlier, like the Jewish community is going to be unpacking and processing what it has supported in this last year and for these last 75 years for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
It's going to be a generational issue and struggle. And one of the things that has kind of, I mean, I think of myself as someone who's somewhat savvy and I know that I'm incredibly naive, but like, I've been shocked. As much as I think about all this stuff, I have still been shocked to the degree to which it is not discussed. It is not allowed to be discussed in any Jewish communal setting. If you are Jewish, if you're in a Jewish organization and you in any way consider yourself under the large communal tent of the Jewish community in, I will just say, the United States, this question has not been begun to be broached in any way whatsoever in this last year, in a year where the quote-unquote Jewish state has been carrying out genocide. It's insane. It's insane. And it's like, I mean, everything that you just described in terms of, you know, the impacts and the stain that it will leave on the community is exactly true. I mean, I will also say this is going to be a generational issue and project, and maybe I'll feel differently at some other point. It's honestly not work I'm really that invested in. I mean, I'll be honest. I mean, I think like the Jewish community and pushing the Jewish community on this question is going to be the last domino. It's the last train car in this train. You know, the Jewish community, one of the ironies here is the Jewish community, and this is would be true even on the left of progressives, of anti-Zionist Jews, think that they are leading this. They are pulling up the far rear on this question. And things, the process that Nora described earlier of Zionism and Israel falling apart will happen and be long over before the Jewish community starts really coming to grips with what this has meant and what has, it's not even to say what has happened in our name, yes, but what like has happened with our direct material support and, you know, political work, you know, this has been the communal project.
Auctioning off stolen land in a synagogue.
Yeah.
And then crying about it when people protest.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like, you did a crime to your religion, bro.
It's twisted.
Like, I'm not the one doing a crime to your religion. You're the one doing a crime to your religion. That's like at the root of all this, like these are anti-Semitic people.
Yes.
Because they use symbols that are for something bigger that seemingly have a meaning to a community of people, of human beings. Normal human beings, and then these people use it as like an axe to smash children to bits, like they paint. You know, I mean, it's not the first imperialist to do this too. Okay, fine. Like this is not new for imperialists, but I return to that statistical problem. There's just not that many Jews on the planet, and the fact that all of the institutions, or the vast majority of them, the material and religious and, you know, political institutions, the parties, the whatever, newspapers, whatever, have been dominated to the point where this fascist project is now like its treasured little baby more than anything else. More than you would think, it's the most pressing issue in the entire world. There's no community things. There's nothing else going on to, like, you know, 6 million Jews in North America other than this Zionism thing, a country half a world away that more than likely just sees them as like a cash cow than anything else. I mean, it's like, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with what Adam said, and it will be the last step in defeating Zionism. That is, you know, that when progressive, you know, self-described liberal American Jews finally come to grips with what Zionism has been, and the effect that it has had on the people in Palestine for so long, that is going to take a long time. And like you said, Adam, way after Israel itself is gone. But yeah, I mean, I don't have, you know, there's a lot of really fantastic Jewish people working inside their communities, in their synagogues, in their community centers, and on the streets, and, you know, working to educate their communities about Zionism and trying to divorce it from being Jewish and Judaism as a religion and a culture. And that's great. And yeah, like you said, Adam, I have no interest in doing that work. I just, like, more power to you if you want to do that. I am busy. Busy with other things.
Is that desire to sort of like unpack the Jewishness of Zionism, like, itself a philo-Semitic thing?
I don't know.
Is it a natural consequence of the fact that Zionists do use like these symbols and these like texts and, you know, these institutions to sort of like cover up and to like, you know, kosherize their violence? Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. Like, I have such a disdain for, you know, like, I don't know, Judaism in my daily life. Like, I'm not disdain, but like, I just don't think about it, you know, like, I can't be bothered. I'm not, you know, when people describe me as like a Jewish American, you know, journal, I'm like, no, I'm just a journal. Like, you wouldn't say that about, like, you know, a Christian journalist. So like,
she's a tanky American.
I'm
okay?
a tanky American. And the work that I do on Palestine has nothing to do with my being Jewish and trying to atone for anything. And sometimes I think that, and I get it, like, people who are working inside the Jewish community to try and divorce it from Zionism, like, there's this way in which, you know, I don't know, I'm probably going to piss a lot of people off by saying this, but like, you know, like, celebrating the tenets of Judaism and doing the like cultural things and the traditional songs and the dances and like lighting the candles and saying, you know, Zionism is not Judaism, and kind of lifting up, you know, the beauty of Judaism and all of our traditions and all of this, and saying, you know, I'm trying to bring like some sort of ritual into it and make it like a religious thing without Zion. I get it. And I'm not, you can't make me, like, I'm not gonna, it's just not
so little effect.
It's had so little effect, and it kind of bolsters, I don't know. It kind of bolsters this thing of like, we are a separate community that needs protection and attention. You know, I mean, my talking about assimilation, like, my grandparents were born in the tenements in New York City. They only spoke Yiddish until they were, you know, school age. They were restricted from so many jobs, right, in the 1920s and 30s. They were Jewish. They only lived around other Jewish people because that was their community, but they wanted to be white so badly. They wanted to assimilate. They, you know,
like a lot of immigrants,
Exactly. And like, I understand that assimilation, you know, from a historical context perspective. I don't know that de-assimilating and, you know, in the context of trying to fight Zionism and once again, kind of emphasizing Jewishness as a part of the struggle for Palestinian liberation. I don't see that as particularly helpful personally. As we were talking about earlier, Adam, like, yeah, there are a lot of really fantastic activists, you know, Jewish American activists who are, who have or assume roles in the Palestine Solidarity Movement. I have a lot of conflicting feelings about that.
Yeah. I mean, to talk some to that dynamic that you were describing around, and, you know, I've been involved in this work for a while and I've been involved in all sorts of different parts of it. So like doing that kind of the anti-Zionist twist on the holiday kind of like, ultimately, when it comes down to it, I'm not seeking to yuck anybody's yum when it comes to this. Yeah. And like what you do in your home, what makes you feel better about your heritage and where you come from, I think that's wonderful for you. There is this element though, say something like, and this is somewhat academic, but not just like this sort of concept of like post-Zionism in terms of like, you know, which is primarily this kind of Jewish movement to be like, actually, you know, like the way I have figured this out and how I could still be happy about being who I am is like, it's just over. Like we don't even have to deal with this anymore because Zionism's over. And we could just go back to like, just pretending like we're Jewish without this. So like, you know, that has impacts in the world that are actively obfuscating the realities of Zionism and what's happening in Palestine. And it happens, you know, some of these lines between public and private are vague at this point. But, you know, we referenced earlier, there was this tweet on Twitter, I guess, talking about how Zionism is not, actually, this is just white supremacy. This is like, this has nothing to do with Jewish people. Actually, Jewish people are victims of Zionism and of white supremacists. There is a way to squint and make this make sense. I get that. But at the end of the day, Zionism is not only a Jewish project, but it's a Jewish project. This has been a project generated out of the Jewish community and has gotten support from a lot of other horrible imperialist forces throughout history. Yes. But there's accountability for that belongs in the Jewish community.
Yeah.
Up until this very afternoon of what our role is, and trying to over-intellectualize or trying to pretend away that this doesn't exist, it's not helpful.
Yeah.
I guess there's a wider question here that I want to ask, but it's also like a specific thing to like kind of the Angloid world that we live in, which is minority as a condition of identity making, right? And how liberals and like this neoliberal era has like, has, you know, forced, let's say, or encouraged us, many people, to make careers out of the thing they call identity. So like, look at me, I'm a gay writer. Like, look at me, I'm an Iranian like youth organizer. Like, people do that because it's like a market niche thing. It's like the same way with jobs, like academic jobs. Like, you had to have like a sexy combination of like adjectives and like adverbs and whatever, and like to like make it sound different, right? And like alterity is something that sells. So like this weird thing that's happened, which is this contradictory thing, which is on the one hand, yeah, like Jews became white.
Yeah.
Jews got absorbed into whiteness. And that's like a historical fact. It's like a straight up fact. And like, and if anything, like part of like this, the difference between how, say, your grandparents, Nora, lived, right, in what used to be called like ethnic ghettos, what are still called ethnic ghettos today. But that's also a story of your historical relation to the class ordering of the society you live in, right? Because that's part of the story of assimilation, the racial, and let's say the de-racialization of Jews in the West has been that they were folded into whiteness in a similar, not an identical way, that like I mentioned earlier, Italians, white Jews, Greeks, whatever.
White Jews.
Yeah, oh, that's true. Yeah, of course. That's another part of this too, is that, yeah.
African like, Jews and
Orientalism still counts
Arab
here.
Jews, yeah.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
and even it works the other way too, to Zionism benefit, so that they use their Oriental Zionists as poster children of their own to obfuscate, obviously, the racial supremacist nature of like this like, you know, like how many Ashkenazis are there versus Sephardim up there in like the decision making? Like, we know there's a racial ordering of Zionist society, and we know who stands at the bottom of it, and when they're not Palestinians, obviously. This is within the Jewish thing. So like their own contradictions of the Zionist project come out, right? And so like this is something that like has made me wonder that like the role of Holocaust culture, Holocaust remembrance culture in all of this, right? Because you brought it up earlier and I wanted to bring it up. And I was like, oh, she brought it up. But that's like, but that the idea of, oh, we now muscular Jews, my advisor Todd Presner writes about this, we muscular Jews, we know better now. We know than we have to smash our enemies and not let them talk shit about us, right? And so you wonder, like, is the entire like project of Holocaust remembrance irredeemably implicated in the Zionist genocide machine? Now, I know that their social media accounts certainly are, right? Like, I know that these like, you know, horrible, you know, like have been captured by all kinds of like the worst right wing, you know, Zionist, but like, I wonder, like, this is an awkward question for me too, because this is also not my personal history, and like my family's history is not wrapped up in the Shoah. So who am I to say that, oh yeah, that thing of yours commemorating a really terrible like act of imperialism and genocide perpetrated against your people with the help of the people who are now helping Israel, by the way. It's not for you to celebrate. It's for you to shut down those institutions because they failed my political litmus test. Like, it's, I'm in a weird position here, but at the same time though, like, it makes you wonder, it's like, oh, they, when they said never again, they meant never again to certain people, which is actually worse.
Yeah. And it's not even, it's sort of even worse than that. Because, I'm not an expert on this, and I'm curious, I know you brought it up, Nora, I'm just going to say something brief, and then I'm curious what you think about this, but like, I would just say, I this is something I'm not an expert on, and I grew up in a household where obviously we talked about the Holocaust, I learned about the Holocaust, but I did not have family in it. This was not an obsessive focus for me or my family growing up, so I kind of took it in as a Jewish person, but more or less through the popular culture. And two of the sort of elements that I remember, which kind of, I think are indicative of the way the Holocaust is used, would both be the Yad Vashem Museum in Jerusalem, mm-hmm, and the movie Schindler's List, which was another one of these kind of major Holocaust moments. And both the museum and the movie end very similarly. Like, you go through the museum. I don't know if either of you have been to the museum, but you kind of wind your way through the horrors of the Holocaust. But then you get to the happy ending, which the happy ending of the museum and the happy ending, according to it, of the Holocaust was the creation of the State of Israel.
Right.
And that's how the movie Schindler's List ends as well. And so in terms of what you just described, I mean, the answer is right in front of our face in terms of, and I don't know, like, Holocaust education is not a monolith necessarily, and I'm sure there are great progressive versions of it that are used to paint other lessons. But the overwhelming sort of establishment narrative and lesson, it's not just the information, but like what you're supposed to take away from is clearly Zionism was the answer to this event that happened, even though it had been in play for, you know, generations before that. But I'm curious.
And Zionist leaders were out, were like working with them. Like,
I mean, I think again, that's going to have to be something that, you know, Western Jews are going to have to figure out. I can sympathize with, you know, people, I mean, my grandparents are all gone now, but, you know, people who are their age, who did survive, you know, either the pogroms or the Holocaust. And of course, you know, wanting a safe place, and unfortunately, you know, Zionism and Europe colluded and said, well, your safe place isn't, you know, going back to Warsaw or going back to Berlin or going back to Paris. Your safe place is now going to be in, you know, Tel Aviv or Jerusalem or Haifa. And I think this was something that Abdeljawad Omar said months ago on a podcast he did on EI in a discussion with Tamara. He was talking about how Europe and the US really let Germany off the hook after the Nazi Holocaust, where, you know, they were made to pay a nominal amount of reparations to victims who survived, but they never carved out a physical, like geographical safe space for Jews who came from Europe. They solved their Jewish problem by pushing them into Palestine, by equipping them with all sorts of military weapons and tools, by turning West Asia into a rampart of Western imperialism. And they never actually had to accept responsibility for Jewish people that they kicked out, expelled, or killed in any, you know, geographical, you know, so political way. And, you know, I think about that a lot. I'm like, you know, what if the next generation or two generations down the line, when it's very, very clear that Israel has never been and will never be a so-called safe place for Jews who aren't from there indigenously. What if, you know, people, instead of going on birthright propaganda trips to so-called Israel, instead went to see villages in Lithuania or Hungary? I've always wanted to do that. I've always wanted to go to Eastern Europe and see where my family actually came from and where they were pushed out of, and what's left of that community, that history. You know, I think that there's going to have to be some reclamation of learning about who we are as Jewish people, and as Westerners in whatever country we happen to now live in. that is both separate from Zionism completely and separate from the crimes of European, you know, leaders. I don't know. I mean, I think there's going to have to be a lot of like generational responsibility and accountability taken, you know, from, I don't know, but, you know, if we start to imagine and plan for Judaism without Israel, Judaism without Zionism, I think that's a good start.
Yeah. And to pick up on one thing that Nora said, which I think also brings us back to the theme of our discussion today, in ways that Nazi Germany, and I don't know if Abdel Jawad talked about this, but the ways Nazi Germany was also let off the hook was that their ideology was never fully interrogated,
which
is really, I say their ideology, it's the ideology of the West. Yeah. And so, you know, and a lot of writers have talked about this, you know, Mahmoud Mamdani, you know, has written about how this kind of like perfect circle of how, you know, Nazi Germany learned from the US and South Africa learned from Nazi Germany and then Israel learned from, you know, and so to talk about philo-Semitism, it's really this kind of circle of ideology that then Jews and Israel became, we are the emblem of what the West stands for. And so if you support us, you support the West. I mean, we all sort of scoff at this shared values thing, but it's actually completely right. Like, yes,
there are shared values
between Israel, Zionism, West, Western supremacy, white supremacy. And so that is not to say we could have answered this really quickly at the beginning of this podcast, but that's kind of the answer. I think I nailed it.
No, I
you
think it's
totally nailed it.
No, it's because it's also part of this weird scam that's been pulled over our eyes and also the eyes of the boomers is drawing up the Nazis as some exceptional force of European savagery. They were one of many. There was many genocides, and in fact, and this is part of the issue that I didn't bring up my previous question is that the reality is that yes, the Shoah has enjoyed or benefits from or whatever or is a product of a exceptional position in the kind of museum industrial historical complex that we live in here. Right, is that it's this one genocide out of a history of settler colonial genocides that make up the fabric of the countries we both live in, respectively, right? This one genocide that took place in Europe receives an inordinate amount of attention compared to the other genocides that are constitutive, right? And so, like, this is one of these issues that's the philo-Semitism problem. Is that like, and Steven Spielberg is actually a great example, right? Because the guy, he does this, you know, like for all intents and purposes, extremely schmaltzy and like very, like, over the top, extra. Like, extra is a word that defines Schindler's List. And yeah, it's an extremely extra film and whatever. Like, it's an aesthetic text or whatever. But ultimately, he turns that movie into a Zionist institutional force because he plugs it in. He's the Shoah Foundation, which he helps fund and people around him help fund, has its home where? In Israel. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, the guy later does Munich, which is a whitewash job on Zionist terror force. And here's a funny story. Zionists were mad at him for not being Zionist enough in that movie. And they gave him shit and he got mad at the Zionists who were like pushing him to do it because he wasn't pro-Zionist enough in that movie. Whitewashing like a Mossad death crew, right? Like this is... And like these twin gestures, you know, and then you think of like the Fablemans, right? His biographical kind of autobiographical thing. It's like, this is a story of philo-Semitism. This is about like this little group of American culture, which are not like the only minority, which are not even by far the largest minority, right? Like, it's that this group has either produced or been on the receiving end of being production of an immense amount of fascination and like discussion and words and images and videos and music and concern, to the point where our politicians fall over themselves saying, oh, God, protect Jewish kids. Except when, of course, when Jewish fascists smash them on the head with boards like they did at UCLA, then they don't really care about Jewish kids, right? Like then the cops just like stand there like that's like this.
Well, again,
is
a wacky, discursive. The right Jewish kids versus the wrong Jewish kids.
Yes. Yeah. Like we like them. We like them. And and like, I don't know, it just feels like this Faustian pact that like some Ashkenazi Jews, like, you know, like wealthy upper class Ashkenazi Jews in like Europe in the 20th century, like began to make, and in the 19th century began to make with like the scum of the earth imperialists. Like this will, I don't know, this will have a framing moment, I think, for, you know, for a long, long time in terms of like whatever we call Jewish history. Like it will be looked back and be like, yeah, we made a Faustian pact with the literal devil.
Yeah.
And we decided to like do their dirty work, and it helped us temporarily, sure. And it gave us a sense of a feeling of home, and it gave our kids something to like. It's that I'm thinking of like Woody Allen's movie Radio Days, where they're like collecting money for whatever, like for Israel. It's like, yeah, it's somewhere over in Egypt. Like they didn't like, no, like why would we give money to Palestine somewhere over in Egypt? Like that's what they said. So, like, and it was like just a cultural thing, but like that's, I think American life is ultimately very hollow, and American power will fade very quickly. And with it, a lot of philo-Semitism will go too. I think that's my thesis, is that like this wave of philo-Semitism, decades long at this point, that we're all a product, that we're all been like ingrained with, more so than probably other generations. I think you're right, Adam. I think it will crumble with Zionism. Because a lot of it was like just flunky kids making, you know, career for themselves in these like spheres that without them, like material backing of like American uber wealth, like won't exist. Mm. Right. Like I don't think.
The fact that you've seen both The Fablemans and Radio Days shows that philo-Semitism is truly out of control.
I'm like obsessed with Jews, guys. I'm obsessed. It's like a philo-Semitism runs like so profoundly in me. Like I'm more obsessed with Jews probably than I am with Iranians. And I'm Iranian. Okay. So like, what's that? What's
so like on? The Shahs of Sunset is definitely your favorite show.
Oh yeah. Are they Jews?
I think. Yeah. A few of them.
God,
I think.
That's
are,
horrible. Yeah.
Iranian Jews.
Oh no. Oh, I didn't realize. I had never watched it.
Don't.
I just thought they were like chuds.
It's terrible. But, it's a Shonda.
Oh, that's terrible. do they make their Jewishness like a point of the show?
Oh, yeah.
Like, oh, no.
Don't ask me how I know.
Breaking news here.
You've heard.
I've heard. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Oh, I don't know. What
but they're Zionists, that? You know, because they are rich and powerful, and they want to be in the elite echelon of that community. You know, it's
you look at those dopey kids and you think these guys are gonna get you through the future. Like you think like these mopeds, like sentient moped losers, like they're gonna get you to like they're gonna defend against Hezbollah, like these guys, like I don't know. I don't have much faith in like American Zionism. Yeah. That like I feel like,
I mean, it's built on a pile of toothpicks, right? Yeah.
There's ultimately still Americans.
Yeah. Like, that's it.
Americans, like, it's like they're Americans first. Yeah. And like, we know American power is so fragile and so hollow. And just to think like how stupid you are. I mean, I guess what choice did Zionists have? But they lease their entire sovereignty to these like goonish neocons. Like this entire thing of theirs, they put in their basket of like these imperialist core, and you just think like this was what you bet on. Like, I mean, I guess there was going to be nothing better than like George Bush and his ilk, but I don't know.
Here we are. Yeah.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah. I don't know.
Thank you guys. This was a lot of fun. I think we probably tapped this one out. It's a hard,
there's so hard much topic. More to talk about.
Yeah, there really is. Like it's it not. Is. I feel like I mean, I've always had this kind of informal like running thing of like, you know, the Jewish question in Zionism of my podcast and kind of running through the show. And occasionally I'll kind of like open that, but it is, it's a case study in what imperialism will do to you. Like as a people, as a group, as like a, like what a dance with like this settler colonial beast of European settler colonialism. Like, I don't know. It's like, I guess maybe I'm guilty of what that guy Yoav was doing in that tweet of like pushing it on ultimate authorship of Zionism to non-Jews. Maybe I'm guilty of that right there. Yeah.
One thing that makes me think about too, I don't know if you both are familiar with, there's a Jewish theologian named Mark Ellis. Like he had written for Mondo Weiss for a while. He sadly passed away a couple months ago. But I remember when he was writing for us often, and he and I would sort of debate all the time about stuff because he cared a lot more about Jewish things than I do. But I forget even how this came up. One day we were kind of talking about the work of Mondo Weiss, and he told me, he's like, you know, what you're doing, what your work is at Mondo Weiss is you are documenting the end of Jewish ethical history. That's what he said. And again, that's never how I have thought about our work, but I never have forgotten that. You know, and I think there is clearly a grain of truth to that.
Yeah.
It's not what animates me, and I think it's a byproduct of what we're doing. But the fact that that's how he understood the documentation of Zionism and hopefully the end of Zionism has always been meaningful to me. So I think that is one of the stories of our time as well.
That's beautifully said. Yeah, I agree.
Thank you, guys. This was really edifying. We're going to keep this conversation going.
Yeah.
Oh, joy.
I have one other thing that to say after the recording's over.
Okay. We'll save that. I'm going to press stop. Yeah, you people won't know what Adam's going to say. You're all a bunch of rubes.
It's for Jews only.
No, I'm sorry. No, please give me Patreon money. I love you guys. Bye.
No, because it was...